Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about the fluorescence of state-level society in early dynastic Mesopotamia and the spread across Mesopotamia of what we really can think about as a civilization, despite political fragmentation in multiple city-states. We see a general regional agreement across the whole area of what rule is supposed to look like, what the relationship between the ruler and the population, the ruler and the city, should look like, and how both of these articulate with the will of the gods and goddesses of the Mesopotamian pantheon. What I want to do today, then, is talk about a very different topic and very different populations, but ones no less vital to the development of complex states and civilizations over Mesopotamia as a whole. The spread of cities in Mesopotamia, separated urban from rural landscapes, and thus in the process creating both. One cannot build a city without simultaneously dividing it from countryside. I've talked about the development of this extraordinarily productive irrigation agriculture system that made the alluvium of particularly southern Mesopotamia the center of economic networks that spread across the Near East. Beyond that intensely exploited and irrigated countryside, beyond the edges of the Tigris and Euphrates River, lay a different landscape, the semi-arid plains that existed between the Tigris and Euphrates floodplains and beyond those floodplains, and the hills of the Mesopotamian peripheries, both often occupied by nomadic pastoral populations. And it's those populations that I want to concentrate on. These pastoralist societies frequently appear as savage raiders in the histories of settled people, both in the past and even in more recent times. Even 4,500-year-old texts from Sumeria, from southern Mesopotamia, display a set of viewpoints on these particular groups of people that we can actually begin to recognize today. The weapon is his companion, who knows no submission, who eats uncooked flesh, who has no house in his lifetime, who does not bury his dead companion. These texts refer to a group of people who were known to Sumerians and other people in Mesopotamia as the Amorites. The Amorites were pastoralists. They were Semitic-speaking populations living along the edges of the settled lands, particularly to the west and northwest of Mesopotamia. In contemporary texts, they're referred to as having large herds of cattle, sheep, and goats. Now, the reference to cattle indicates that they were not desert dwellers. The fact that one of the chief sources of wealth for Amorite populations was herds of cattle implies that they're not living in the deserts that surrounded Mesopotamia that existed, for example, to the west of Mesopotamia, but that they must have been living in the intermediate zones between those deserts and the floodplains of the Tigris and Euphrates. We don't know a great deal about the economic adaptations of these Amorite people, about how this pastoralist system actually worked, but we will see them playing a role in Mesopotamian history later on. Now, if we think of stereotypical views of pastoral nomadic populations, if we think, for example, of Bedouin populations or Berber peoples of the Sahara, If we think of Western Native American populations, groups of people like the Apache, for example, or in classical times, groups like the Huns, they're usually actually presented in similar ways to the Amorites. They're conceived of by settled peoples in more or less the same way that Mesopotamian populations living in the city-states, living in settled communities, saw pastoralists like the Amorites as proud, untamed, whatever that means, mobile, and dangerous. This is the association that farmers have had about herders for a very long time. I will note that, for example, it's still the way that farmers talk about pastoralists in the areas of Africa that I work in Chad, Cameroon, and Nigeria, for example. The relationships between the two groups, between farmers on the one hand and herders on the other, are actually quite advantageous to both groups at different times of the year. The way this works is that pastoralist populations move into farmers' fields after crops had been harvested. They then graze on the remains, the stubble in the fields, and the manure from the animal actually fertilizes the fields. It's quite a positive relationship for both groups, but at the same time, these tensions remain. This might just be a question of marginality, as with hunting and gathering populations, who we often also see occupying these sort of very ambivalent positions in the belief systems of more settled groups. Both herders and hunters and gatherers operate on the peripheries of settled land, away from the homes of farmers. This tense relationship may also be in part a reputation for military success that tends to be associated with the mobility of herding groups. Herding populations are often seen as dangerous. In fact, the economies and social systems of farmers on the one hand and herders on the other were probably closely intertwined in Mesopotamia, as they are, as I said, through much of West and Central Africa today. Pastoralism is an economic term. It describes a particular economic adaptation. It involves some degree of dependence of human populations on domesticated animals for subsistence. But in fact, it's far more than a simple economic term. It has all kinds of cultural and political implications as well. Political implications certainly in Mesopotamia, as we're going to see. For pastoralist populations, for herders, animals act as a locus of cultural value. One's cattle, one's camels, one's horses, one's sheep and goats are not merely economic things, but important cultural, often ritual and social goods, in every sense of the term, in their own right. Now, we have to note three things about this very specific pastoralist adaptation that have a great deal of consequence for thinking about the relationship between pastoralists and farmers. First, it appears to be impossible for pastoralists to survive purely upon the products of their herds for substantial periods. Whether these herds are producing meat, milk, cheese, other kinds of animal products, human populations are not surviving when they act as herders. They're not surviving exclusively on the product of their herds. Doing so makes communities too vulnerable to fluctuations in herd size through, for example, disease or environmental difference, and makes it hard for young people to start new households on their own. This means that almost inevitably, herders are going to have some economic relations with farming populations, often involving exchange of products. This, of course, in Mesopotamia, during the early dynastic period, would bring them into contact with early states. Just to note again, as a third thing, dependence on animals by herding populations can mean a lot of things. That term dependence, there's an economic dependence, a subsistence dependence, but as I noted as well, there's a huge ideological investment in remaining a herder. And what this often involves as well is a sort of a return of the suspicion and contempt that farmers often direct towards herders. So a dependence of pastoral populations on their farming neighbors may have rather variable meaning economically and politically. Now, the semi-arid plains of Mesopotamia are not well suited for agriculture away from water sources. And I've talked about this in previous lectures, the fact that really what made agriculture feasible in southern Mesopotamia was the provision of irrigation systems. Because away from the rivers, away from water sources, it was simply too dry for successful and reliable agriculture to take place. But of course, you can't extend irrigation systems across the entire map. And mobile pastoral populations may well have occupied the blank spaces on archaeological maps of Mesopotamia. And there are a lot of such blank spaces on the maps. One thing to note here is that pastoralists, to the degree that they're mobile, and they usually need to be at least relatively mobile because their herds will overgraze local resources otherwise, so they tend to move around quite a bit. Because of this, they don't tend to leave many traces on the landscape, and so they can be very hard to detect archaeologically. We're obviously not going to find tell mounds associated with mobile pastoral populations, with mobile cattle herding populations, for example. It would be pointless to erect a permanent structure that took a great deal of effort out of mud brick, for example, if you're only going to be in an area for a month or two. And so one of the things that archaeologists have to deal with, one of the challenges for archaeologists looking at the prehistory of pastoralism in Mesopotamia, is that actually the traces of the pastoralists can be extremely hard to detect. So researchers working in this area have suggested that pastoralism in Mesopotamia actually developed in symbiosis with irrigation agriculture. And we can actually understand very easily how this works. Irrigation agriculture dramatically decreases the mobility of farmers. One's tied with this agricultural system to close association with an irrigation system, with those water sources. It's much more difficult in this situation to move around. This, in turn, makes it less efficient for farmers to keep herd animals that might have to be moved, in fact, that would almost certainly have to be moved, to distant pastures at different times of the year. And so specialized pastoralist economies appear to fill this economic niche. So we can see a situation in which these two ways of life, these two economic systems, are drawing apart in the 4th and 3rd millennia BC. It's, in a sense, a way of specializing in order to use the entire Mesopotamia landscape, not merely the floodplains of the Tigris and Euphrates River, but the entire landscape more efficiently. Nomadism, and by that I mean settlement mobility, doesn't have to go along with pastoralism, but it very frequently does. As I said, herds almost always overgraze if they're not being fed domesticated grass, which is a process that began happening rather later in time. Nomadism this settlement mobility does not imply wandering aimlessly around the landscape. And in fact, nomadic pastoralists will often have very sophisticated seasonal rounds. It may be hard for archaeologists to tell, actually, whether the different parts of this seasonal cycle of occupation of different areas is actually the result of movement by the same group of people. Because settlement patterns may well be different during different times of the year. There may be times, for example, at which communities aggregate. And so you'll have large numbers of people living in a single community. And then at other times, the same group of people, in order to make better use of the resources, may disperse, may split up into smaller groups, into smaller camps. On the borders of Mesopotamia, historical sources show that nomads were often closely related to more sedentary farmers. So there was actually social and cultural relationships between them, where, for example, intermarriage was going on between farming and herding populations. And at certain times of the year, pastoralists, cattle pastoralists, would leave produce and other goods in storage with farmers while they went off to exploit their herds and pastures in other areas. Ethnically, it's possible that they would have considered themselves to all actually be the same people. Now, what can we say about pastoralists and states? We can conceptualize the relationship between pastoralists and these developing city-states in Mesopotamia during the early dynastic period in two different ways. We can talk first about the roles played by pastoralists on the peripheries of early states. This is, in some ways, a question that is relatively well developed in archaeology. Archaeologists have paid a fair amount of attention to it. How did pastoralists living out beyond the Tigris and Euphrates floodplains, for example, how did they deal with those states that existed on the floodplain? There were certainly well-known pastoralist populations like the Amorites that I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture, living in what is now Syria and Iraq, existing on the territories on the edges of Mesopotamian city-states, and it would seem in many cases these populations, like these Amorites, are well integrated into Mesopotamian communities more broadly. So that's one issue. We can look at the relationships between pastoralist populations and already existing agricultural states. We can also examine the development of political complexity among pastoralists themselves. That is, at what point can we think about state formation happening within pastoral societies? This is a somewhat more difficult question. It's obvious that a considerable degree of political complexity existed among numerous pastoralist groups at different points. If we think about, for example, the Mongol Empire, here we have a vast political unit, a vast empire that develops among pastoralists. But the processes of state formation in such societies are often not well understood. How did these pastoralists make states on their own? Thus, for example, the Amorites themselves established kingdoms in Mesopotamia at the end of the 3rd millennium BC, during a period of political fragmentation in the region. We know about this, actually, primarily from written archives found at a site called Mari, situated on the Euphrates River in northern Mesopotamia in what's now Syria. And these archives, these written archives, I'll be referring back to them next time. They're extraordinary. 25,000 clay tablets. The diplomatic archives of a small state in northern Mesopotamia. The Mari archives depict Mary itself as the capital of an Amorite kingdom. That is, a kingdom that in some sense developed out of these Amorite pastoralist populations. There thus seems to be a situation where these pastoralists had settled down and in some way gained control of this pre-existing urban center at the end of the 3rd millennium BC. Mary had existed as an urban center early in the 3rd millennium BC as well, so there's some way in which Amorite pastoralists gained control of the levers of power, if you like, of the Mary state. Mary seems to have prospered through control of river traffic on the Euphrates, agriculture, and extensive cattle herding. Populations associated with the Amorite rulers spent summer months along the Euphrates and then migrated with their herds into the mountains to the north during the winter. It seems that what was going on at Mary was a very successful combination of pastoralism and agriculture, making use of these close relationships between city dwellers, urban dwellers in Mary itself, and herders. Now, the complexity in this situation is trying to account for the relationships between the ruler of Mary and the elite of Mary, who are identified as Amorites, but who are presumably not going out and actually taking their herds off into the mountains every winter. That doesn't seem to be the case. So exactly what was the relationship at the end of the 3rd millennium BC between these rulers who are identified as Amorites and the people who are actually doing the herding? Are they all considered one ethnic group? What are the social and historical and kinship ties between them? One interesting thing to note here is that the geographical territories of kingdoms like Mary seem to be larger than those of the early dynastic city-states. Now remember the timing here. Early dynastic period, earlier in the 3rd millennium BC, from approximately 2900 to 2400 BC, and states like Mary succeeded, seem to have rather larger territories. We don't know whether this was due to specifically Amorite conceptions of what the state should look like. Is it the case, for example, that people who are culturally and historically pastoralists, who are specifically mobile populations, used at least traditionally to moving around from one place to another, are going to have larger territories than settled irrigation farmers? Or perhaps just that the idea of territorial states, of states that covered larger areas, was becoming more widespread in Mesopotamia at this time. We really don't know. But it is interesting that a state that's controlled by populations that identify themselves traditionally as pastoralist actually has a larger territory than the city-states that I've been talking about up to this point. As I said, pastoral populations, with their mobility and relatively impermanent material culture, tend not to be very visible archaeologically. Researchers working in Mesopotamia have not tried very frequently to locate pastoralist sites specifically, because in the first place, they already have an abundance of large and complex agricultural and urban sites to work with, an embarrassment of riches. And second, because written texts provide information on pastoralists, although that information is sometimes biased and incomplete. However, archaeologists have paid more attention to some of the peripheries of Mesopotamia. For example, the Zagros Mountains of western Iran. This area is very important in the history of Mesopotamia. Nomads, populations who are known as Gudians, originating in the northern part of the Zagros Mountains, are said to have been responsible for the fall of the Akkadian state that Sargon of Akkad established in Mesopotamia in the late 3rd millennium BC. And you can imagine from what I've said about pastoralists, the idea of these wild, untamed, dangerous, mobile nomads storming out of the Zagros Mountains and invading the heartland of settled Mesopotamia and overthrowing the state that Sargon established. Over the last 20 years, a variety of researchers have done intensive archaeological survey work in areas of the Zagros Mountains where the Gutians may well have originated. They've uncovered a complex history of occupation in this area. During the Zagros Neolithic, which is roughly the Hassunan period in Mesopotamia, if you remember my chronology from the last few lectures, village-based herding was part of a mixed economy in the Zagros. People were also engaged in some farming and hunting and gathering. These Zagros Neolithic communities were more or less self-sufficient, and there's no evidence of site hierarchy or significant social ranking. And no evidence during the Zagros Neolithic period for specialized groups of pastoralists. At this time, economic systems in the Zagros probably generally resembled those in the Mesopotamian plains to the west. Populations in the Zagros Mountains seem to have then climbed during the period that we call the Early and Middle Chalcolithic, which is essentially equivalent to Ubaid to early Uruk times in Mesopotamia, the 5th and early 4th millennia BC. And it's probable that economic specialization between farmers and pastoralists began at that time as populations reached the limits of rain-fed and very simple agricultural systems in the mountains. And it's over this period, so the equivalent of Ubaid, early Uruk period, that complex interdependencies between Zagros farmers and pastoralists evolved. And again, as in Mesopotamia itself, this allowed a more complete exploitation of local environments than would have been possible with either adaptation on its own. This is the complementarity of farming and herding. You can use environments in a general sense much more efficiently. There's ceramic evidence of cultural and trade relations between Zagros pastoralist populations and Ubaid communities to the west during the 5th millennium BC. So this, we can see evidence in trading relationships. They're moving materials back and forth. There's resemblances in ceramics between the two areas. What this indicates is that the Gutian invasion of the 3rd millennium BC was only one episode in a long history of interaction between the Zagros Mountains and the floodplains of the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia. These complex relations between farmers and pastoralists would characterize cultural developments through much of the old world in succeeding millennia. Pastoralists really, in some ways, don't get enough examination in considerations of the rise of states and civilizations, at least from an archaeological point of view, because, as I said, archaeologically, they're hard to study. But they were extraordinarily important, not merely in Mesopotamia, but in many other areas of the old world as well. I mentioned a few moments ago this tremendous diplomatic archive discovered at the Mesopotamian town of Mari. I'm going to refer back to that in my next lecture as I speak about the development of writing systems in Mesopotamia. Thank you.